Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pivot Podcast. We're thrilled to welcome a Nova Scotia Sport Hall of Fame inductee and curling icon both at home and on the international stage. Amongst his many accomplishments in the sport of curling, Mark Dacey is the 2004 Brier Champion representing Team Nova Scotia, in addition to reaching the podium at the World Championships in Sweden the very same year, earning a bronze for Canada. After his retirement from the sport, Mark has reinvented himself a number of times, and we're grateful he is here with us to share his journey and lessons learned along the way. Welcome, and thank you for joining us, Mr. Mark Dacey.
Thank you. Thank you, John, for having me.
Mark, I was watching footage of the 2004 Brier when your rink defeated Furby's rink and had that epic comeback. I think you were down like 8-4 in the seventh end, and I think it's one of the most, most epic comebacks in, I think, Canadian curling history, I think it's safe to say. I can't believe we're on the cusp of 20 years of that victory. What do you remember most reflecting on it almost 20 years on?
There's a few immediate things that come to mind. I think, one of the first ones is my father ran out on the ice after the game. They typically wouldn't allow a fan to jump the boards, and they would be security there to stop them. But everybody, yeah. It was in Saskatoon, and everybody knew my dad. It was my hometown. So they're like, go run, George, go see your son. Right? So he met me at mid-ice, and that embrace still sticks with me today because he's not with us anymore. So it was almost as if that was a crescendo of everything we did leading up to that moment. And the morning before the game, I was at breakfast with my wife Heather and our son Ty, who was 4 months old, and he was sitting in his stroller that morning, laying in a stroller, looking up at a ceiling fan, and he just, like, 4 months old. You know, sometimes they're wailing away crying, and sometimes they're asleep. But in this situation, he was staring at the ceiling fan, and he just looked so at peace. You know, when I looked at him, and I almost looked at him, and I drew the piece that he had, and I took it into myself, and I carried that feeling with me through the day and into the game that night, and because I basically felt that regardless of win or lose the game, I have this beautiful child, and he was new to our addition to our family and my first one, so I kind of think that. That allowed me to not feel additional pressure that I might have applied on myself. Yeah. Of course, the game, as it went on, was starting to get a little disappointed with myself because the team was playing well and I wasn't finishing off opportunities. And after the seventh end, it was 8-4. And, it was kind of looking like Furby was going to win their fourth one and we were going to lose our second final in a row. At the time, during the commercial break, the seventh end break, our fifth man, our ultimate player, Matt Harris, met me at center ice, where the rest of the team was down at the far end, and they were probably murmuring about how lousy I was playing. Matt met me and said something along the lines of, get your head in the game. There's still some time left here, and he said, a lot of strange things happen in Brier Finals. So, let's go. 3 minutes to go here. And so Matt took my brain and flipped it from thinking about the questions I'd be answering after 10 ends about losing twice in a row to something more along the lines of, you're right. Let's make them earn it. All right. It's theirs. They've won it, but let's just not hand it to them on a platter. Let's make them earn it. And that mindset switch at that moment in time freed me up to play well for the last three ends, and Furby's team made a few mistakes and we jumped all over them, and next thing you know, we get three, they get one, we get three, and just like that, in the blink of an eye, we were Brier champions.
So. Did you do you talk about the importance of mindset? Like, we had Ellie Black on and she was talking about, a sports psychologist she was working with and all that. Was that common at the time?
Yeah, we definitely worked with some of the Atlantic Sports Center resources we had. Okay. And some of those resources included sort of mental training, the ability to focus, the ability to stay in the moment, the ability to let things go quickly, mental strengthening. I was already very mentally tough myself, but in high pressure situations, it's easy to let your mind wander into the wrong spaces.
Why do you think you were mentally tough already?
People told me that. People told me that. Okay. I think I was pretty weathered from all kinds of difficult losses leading into that. So losing in curling is a little bit like getting knocked down in a boxing ring.
Sure.
You can choose to lay there and give up, or you can choose to get back up and potentially get some more punishment, right?
Yeah.
And I always chose to get back up and get more punishment. But each time I had a new bruise or scar and battle wound, and that's sort of what toughened me up for that moment in time.
Yeah, I challenge anyone who's listening to this to go on YouTube and watch the last, what, 3-4 ends of that that battle, and tell me you weren't white knuckling it the whole time, because it's just so suspenseful. And as a Nova Scotian, maybe I'm biased, but I was, you know, obviously rooting for you the whole time. And I'm like, oh my God. And when it finally happened, it was just, I mean, unbelievable.
It was one of the first times as well that they moved the final to Sunday prime time. So it was, it was 6 or 7 o'clock in Saskatoon. I think it was 6 p.m. So it would have been 7 or 8 Eastern, and probably 9 Atlantic. So when the score was 8-4, it was also, you know, well past 11 p.m. in Nova Scotia. So a lot of people, you know, turned TV off and go to bed, right? Because Monday morning.
Yeah, that's funny. That's a good point. Yeah.
And so we heard endless stories of, I can't believe I didn't watch the last three ends live.
And the arena was packed. I mean, you look at it online, it was like, I mean, bigger than our Scotiabank arena here, I think, capacity wise.
Yeah, it's, you know, Saskatoon's where I grew up. It's my hometown, and it's a curling hotbed.
Oh, yeah.
Always has been. I mean, it hasn't won a Brier in Saskatchewan since 1980 in Rick Folk. But a lot of people from Saskatchewan have won the Brier. They just won it after they transplanted themselves. And it's definitely a curling hotbed. It was, you know, it was kind of always something that almost everybody did back home in the winter.
And what, so as Jeff mentioned earlier, we have spoken to a number of elite athletes, of which, you know, you're one. And each one has attributes a different reason for what made them successful, kind of a distinguishing characteristic, both themselves, either mentally, physically, both, that separates them from the pack.
Yeah.
So as you reflect on you growing up as a boy to, you know, as a man playing a professional, as a professional curler, what do you think separated you from the pack to get you to the levels that you've achieved?
I think it was just like a burning desire inside my stomach to succeed. I grew up in a family of all boys. I'm the youngest. I have 4 older brothers. And so I was roughhoused and picked on and teased a fair bit and, you know, sort of sat on and white-knuckled to the side of the head sort of thing. So I grew up having to, you know, just sort of battle with my older brothers and become very competitive because of that. And then in 1980, when Rick Folk won the Brier for Saskatchewan, that was on television. It was one of the first times that, you know, the entire final was, because it used to be before that, they would show little snippets and there would be some highlight packages, but they finally went to live broadcast of the final game. And so Rick Folk won in 1980. I was 13 years old at the time, and I watched it. I remember watching it and going, that looks cool. Like, I want to do that. Mm. Right? And a seed was planted at that moment.
So you knew just watching.
I did, just watching
without it. Without even having thrown a rock before in your life.
Yeah. Oh, I had thrown rocks before, but I had never really thought, wow, I want to be a national
champion.
At that
level,
right?
Okay.
So Rick Folk had a store in Saskatoon called Folk's Curling Corner. And about a week or 2 weeks after he won, my father took me down to meet Rick at his curling store and bought me a new slider and a new broom, whatever. Rick autographed my broom. And, you know, I'm just a 13-year-old kid meeting the guy I just saw on TV. And I still remember that clearly, and how much that took that little seed and that fire that I had in my belly and started to make it grow and roar. And so I was pretty energetic, hyper intense as a kid. And I carried that right through into my adult life, and I still get, you know, called intense sometimes in today's world. But I was, that's what
never
I was known
for. Never
made myself.
Never.
But that's what I was known for when I started competing in my, when I became like 20 years old and all the way into my, through my 20s was kind of a hyper intense skip.
Because I remember you telling me a story before, you know, in preparation for this discussion about you and Colleen Jones and how I think you belong to the same club in Halifax, right? You trained at the Mayflower.
Yeah.
And how, of all the members, you were often the last two still throwing rocks after everybody else presumably went to work or went about their day. You were still there doing your thing.
Yeah. Most people were squeezing in 30 or 45 minute practices or 60 minute practices, and they were doing it either individually or as a team, and usually at lunch hour at the Mayflower. And Colleen and I often but coincidentally would be there a little earlier, more like 10 or 10:30 in the morning. Sometimes there was a morning ladies league going on or a morning men's league going on, and the sheets were full, and you'd have to wait for one of the games to end. And then as soon as the game ended, you'd jump on the empty sheet and start practicing. But there was many times I remember where she was there throwing, I was there throwing, and then all the people who could only have the lunch hour window would come in and throw, and they would depart. And then she would still be there throwing. And
you'd still be there.
And it's
she did okay as well.
Yeah, she did far greater than I ever did. But the quantity of rocks that she threw and the quantity of rocks I threw, made a difference, because it just gave you that repetitive motion so well that you could count on it in the most difficult moments, where when pressure is increased, typically that's when fundamentals or mechanics will potentially fail you. But when you ingrain it so deeply, you can rely on your mechanics to repeat themselves.
Did you play any other sports as a kid, or were you really focused on curling?
Well, golf was kind of my other sport. I did play hockey as a kid, but I was always small. I was, for my age and my grade, I was always one of the smallest kids.
Yeah.
So when I played hockey and I had all this spirit and energy and competitive fire, and somebody would basically just touch me and I'd be fall off the puck, it was like frustrating, because I was battling strength and size and I didn't have any. And then when I discovered curling, it was like, oh, and same with golf. You mean you get the rock and nobody tries to take it away from you and nobody tries to interfere you while you throw it? I like that, right?
Yeah.
And golf was the same
thing.
Very
technical sports, yeah.
Yeah, anything that didn't involve contact or somebody trying to tackle me was more up my alley.
Sure.
Yeah.
You talk about where you grew up. It was, I think you called it a hot spot for curling.
Yeah, hotbed, yeah.
Hotbed. Is it still?
Yeah.
Are young people still curling to the same degree, or like what's that scene look like?
I haven't been as involved in the game in the last 5 years as I was prior to that. My kids curl now. So in Nova Scotia, when I go to any of the junior tournaments, my youngest is 15, he just turned 16. So he played a number of tournaments this past fall and winter, and they were jam-packed. I mean, when I say jam-packed, there's lots of teams in them, and there was lots of parents around, and there was lots of grandparents around, lots of people there watching. It does seem like, the game has a lot more youth that are entering it, before their end of their high school and before they start university. And then that becomes sort of the breaking point on whether they can continue with it, the commitment or not, because it does require a time commitment and it doesn't have huge financial rewards. So there's a balance you got to find.
So speaking of the financial rewards, were you working full time while you were doing a lot of this? Like, what were you doing while you were curling, if anything?
Yeah, I was definitely working. Everybody that was at the high level back then had another life.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was wondering. Yeah.
Right? Mine was golf business was a big part of it from probably mid '90s all the way up to about 2000 and. Five or so. So about 10 to 12 years I spent in the golf business, and that gave me my winters free to curl, and that was one of the appeals.
Okay. Yeah.
One of the big appeals for me to go into the golf industry was so that it freed up my winters to curl. So condense all your work into, 6 to 8 months, free up about 4 months, and go curling. So a lot of people that were on the circuit back then were also in the golf business.
And you ended up as the pro for a period of time at Fox Harbor here in Nova Scotia. And I know that you built quite a relationship with the late Ron Joyce, who, of course, as we know, is the founder of Tim Hortons.
Yeah.
And I was just interested in knowing more about what you learned from Ron, like how that relationship was built and what you learned from him over the years.
Yeah. Ron is, he's an icon and he's a wonderful man. And he treated me great. And I have, the ultimate respect for him and his legacy. I had an interview in March of 2000, and that was that was, sorry, it was 2001, March of 2001. It was right after we got back from the Briar. So I had just gotten my Class A certification with the CPGA, the Professional Golfers Association of Canada. And I had was applying for head pro jobs, and I saw one come available at Fox Harbor. So I applied thinking, I'm never going to get this job. But, you know, you don't get anything you don't apply for, right? So we went and curled in the Briar, came back. And I had a message to give Fox Harbor a call because they wanted me to come up for an interview. So it was like the Tuesday after we had just gotten back, and I got back Monday, and I didn't even really know exactly where Fox Harbor was, and I didn't know who Ron Joyce was. So anyway, I went up and I met with Sherry Spicer, who was the president at the time, and then she took me from the main clubhouse over to the hangar building where the interview was going to happen, and Ron was part of the interview along with several others.
He was in the interview?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff was sitting on the runway and it was sort of getting warmed up, ready to go. So wow. He had set up a few interviews that week, but he had mentioned the curling and the Briar. He was a fan, and we had had a pretty good run in that particular Briar. I think losing our last round robin game to miss the playoffs by one game. And so I remember him asking, you know, how that ended and, you know, what could we have done different and stuff like that. And what he liked about me in the interview was that I didn't behave in a nervous or anxious fashion. I didn't look at him as somebody to be fearful of, or
he said he didn't really know who
I didn't
was,
know who so he was. Yeah. I had no clue. So then he set me on a little on a golf cart with the superintendent at the time, Barry Scott, and said, "Give Mark a tour around." And so he showed me like the rental properties, and he showed me, and this is like we're talking March in Tatamagush or in that area, and it's freezing cold and windy. And so anyway, he showed me a little bit about around the golf course and some of the features. We came back to the hangar and he said, "When could you start? What's your salary expectations? And we'll be in touch." And the next thing you know, the jet was in the air. So he makes decisions like that, right? He's that kind of guy. He sees someone he likes or something he likes.
So he had a gut feel, you think, and just you guys hit it off right away.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And then he treated me well for the entire 4 years that I was there. And it was very entertaining, to say the least.
And would you consider him like a business mentor of yours? Because, I mean, he opened up other doors for you subsequent to that opportunity, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I grew up in Saskatchewan, and so I transplanted to Nova Scotia. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, I didn't have, you know, my parents were back. So I had some father figures here. One of them was, you know, my coach in curling, Peter Corkum. And then, of course, Ron, although I never would think of him like that. He certainly, you know, his age and demographic aligned with my father's. And so, but I always got a kick out of him because he never knew what was coming out of his mouth next or what his behavior was going to be like next. He definitely taught me a lot of things that I still apply in life today.
Such as?
I remember we were waiting for delayed flights one time and trying to get home from Hamilton, and I had called him because he had his private jet company in Hamilton that often flies back to Fox Harbor, and I said, "Is there any of your jets going back to Fox Harbor, because we're stuck in Hamilton, and it sounds like it's going to be a couple of days." It was coming home from a curling event and there was a snowstorm. So he said, "Just go to the counter," and he said, "Use the expression, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So you don't stop squeaking until you get what you need, right? Just stay there and ask to speak to somebody." And eventually, you know, that worked, right? Wow. And he just had these expressions that he would use sometimes that made sense, right? And just like his marina, for his deep water marina at Fox Harbor, where he parks, you know, his gigantic boats, he needed a place to park them with, you know, and when he didn't have that spot at Fox Harbor and to create it, they drilled a bunch of holes in the rock and they threw some dynamite in them and they exploded it out, right? They didn't get the permits to do that ahead of time. They never would have got the permits, right? So, of course, the same old expression, it's easier to be forgiven than get permission.
Nice permission.
Yeah. So he got a fine for doing that, but the fine ended up being no different than if he had went through the whole, it just was a lot quicker.
Right.
So he just thinks in a fashion that's like so old fashioned.
He knew he would get fined.
Yeah, he knew he'd get fined. Yeah. And he knew, he was just like, just do it. We need a place to park the boat, so we'll just do it. He told, I think it was George Vogel, who was his engineer and sort of landscaping guy. And he just said, just go blow it out.
Blow it out.
And all the rock that came flying out, they, you know, with heavy equipment, they moved it over to the 16th tee box. Yeah. And they created a tee box out in the water.
With the stone. Yeah.
Yeah, with the stone. So it's a really cool story that that stone came from.
I didn't realize that was the case. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you're standing on the 16th tee, you're actually standing on the rock that was exploded out of the arena.
Oh my gosh. Cool. I'll never look at that hole the same again.
Yeah.
So transitioning out of that, did you end up owning a Tim Hortons yourself? Do you still own one, actually?
Yeah. So in 2005, Ron connected me with Steve Johnston, who was then the Atlantic VP for development for franchisee development with Tim Hortons. And Ron wasn't involved with the company anymore at that point, but he still was well connected with the right people. And he basically, I was looking to get back to the city. We had a child on the way. So that was before Ty arrived, and we had talked about raising our family in Pugwash or Wallace or Tatamushery, and we kind of concluded that we preferred to be in the city for the children's sakes, for the family's sake, and for we just felt more comfortable with raising a family in the city. So I started to look for something outside of Fox Harbor, and I told Ron that. And told him some of the ideas I was looking at, and he basically told me my ideas were crap, and that and that he should that if I wanted, he could, you know, link me with the right people in Tim Hortons. So we went down that road, and then eventually, about a year later, we were offered an opportunity on Dutch Village Road in Fairview, with two locations. And one of them, that was in 2005. So one of them eventually closed in 2010 because it was an old sit-in one with no drive-through and no ability to add a drive-through. And it was, sales were declining year over year. And it was, you know, sort of bleeding a slow death. But the other one was an Esso station non-traditional restaurant. So a kiosk with a drive-through. And when we closed the one on Dutch Village, well, they were both on Dutch Village, but when we closed the sit-in one, the sales of that one pretty much all went over to the drive-thru.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
so okay. All of a sudden, we had a high volume, like super high volume drive-thru one that didn't require as much work to it because it didn't have all the seating and bathrooms and all the extra maintenance involved. And all of a sudden, I was in a really, really good situation with that one.
Do you still have it?
No, I ended up selling it in 2016. I had a bit of a paradigm switch when my parents took ill back in 2013 to 2015, and their health deteriorated quickly with dementia and Alzheimer's. Right. Eventually passed away, mom in 2016, dad in 2019. And during that time, I just got to thinking, you know, is that where my destiny lies as well? Like, am I going down this path? And so I took a real change in mindset and started focusing more on health and wellness, with starting with myself and then thinking, you know, how can I extend that to other people as well?
Both parents around the same time with all?
Yeah, one after the other. So mom from 2013 passed away in 2016, dad around 2015, 2016 started, and then passed away in 2019.
Terrible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they're in Saskatchewan. So when I went back to visit, each time it got worse and worse and worse, and they wouldn't remember who I was. And they would ask the same questions over and over. And the healthcare facilities were, you know, pretty sad to visit. You know, just the conditions were fine, but the people were wandering around, not really living. They're just waiting to die, essentially. And that's where you really felt.
And that was a real turning point for you. I remember, I mean, even just hearing you talk now, I mean, when you see your parents kind of succumb to that kind of an illness, Alzheimer's, as I'm assuming that but it also gave you time to kind of think about, okay, clearly where you were at that point in your life, you were successful, you were accomplished, you had, you know, you had money, you were fine, but you wanted to kind of reinvent yourself because of what you saw and the state that your parents were in. So if you think back on that time and what led you to the next chapter in your journey in terms of, you mentioned health and wellness. Talk to us about that, because you're doing something pretty interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, when I sold the Tim Hortons, that was in 2016, I didn't know what I was going to do next. But what I did know was that I was going to create a checklist of things that were important to me and make another checklist of things that I didn't want to do. You know, being in the food business wasn't that appealing to me anymore. I wanted to be in a business that felt like it would, you'll have a positive impact on the world. It could be the smallest of impacts locally, or, you know, could extend further, but it definitely had to feel like I left a positive impact. I wanted something that, you know, I feel proud of, to eventually, if my kids ever wanted to take it over, that they could, they could be proud to take it over. And because Tim's was a franchise, I felt that franchise business is probably best suited for me, because I understand the whole idea of, you know, don't try to invent the system, just follow.
Use the model.
Use the model, right? Follow the execution guide. Yeah. So I started looking at franchises, and then I discovered Orange Theory, which Brad Dushu owned in Newfoundland. And when I first heard about it, I reached out to him right away to ask him how it's going. And I didn't hear back right away, but within a couple of weeks, he reached out and said, it's going very well here. In fact, I love the model. He said, if you're interested in developing Nova Scotia, I'd be interested in partnering with you. So we continued those discussions, and we started looking to buy the rights. The one thing we thought is, if we develop it in Halifax, we didn't want to open one and then have somebody else open another one, say in Dartmouth or Bedford or wherever. So when we approached Orange Theory Fitness Canada, we wanted to have the rights to develop the area, to get the region. And to get the region, they wanted us to buy two licenses at once to confirm that we were going to. So we strategized and talked thoroughly and created a plan, a roadmap, and we went ahead and purchased those two licenses with the idea that, you know, let's find a location for the first one, and then as soon as that one's up and running, let's start looking for the second one.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at you now. We're not filming this, obviously, but you're in amazing shape. You're just...
Well...
I'm looking at myself. I'm like, oh, man.
No, right. No. I mean, we're
all... You give me something to aspire to when I'm up there. But tell us more about Orange Theory, because there's it's a unique... You have a unique differentiator compared to kind of other gym models, if you will, or other franchises. So what is Orange Theory?
Well, it's all science-backed and technology-tracked, coach-inspired. Group workouts, 1 hour long. So it's the intention of it, when somebody comes to one of our classes, is that they don't have to plan, they don't have to think, they just have to show up, be able to follow guidance. And if they struggle anywhere along the time with any of that guidance, the coach is there to guide and inspire, but also to correct their form, correct their technique. So somewhat like personal training. So it's personal training in a group setting. The 1 hour classes, they use a combination of treadmills where we do heart rate based interval training. And that's where the science of the workouts come, is heart rate based interval training is scientifically proven to torch calories, to melt fat, and to supercharge your metabolism. And it works. It's all about getting your heart rate up, back down for active recovery, and then doing that again several times in the workout. When you strengthen your heart, you strengthen your metabolism, and you burn a ton of calories. That's combined with water rowing machines, where we do core and power training, and the weight floor, where we do strength and resistance training. It's all jam-packed into an hour, and there's a lot of transitions during one of the classes. And again, you don't have to think as a client. You don't think. The coach guides everything and corrects you if you start doing anything wrong or go to the wrong place. Like, they fix you up right away.
You got me thinking of that line on Top Gun Maverick. Don't think, just do.
Yeah, just do it, right? Just follow.
I think people do overthink the... You know, there's so much psychology at play when it comes to health and fitness.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, well, I had a cheeseburger for lunch, so I guess I should just throw it away the rest of the day.
Yeah.
Or... Well, I didn't sleep well, so I'm going to skip my workout this morning, right? Yeah. Anyway, there's just so much at play there.
Yeah, like in our classes, we get people out of their comfort zone. Like, you know, there's music playing. Of course, we'll turn up a little bit. The coach is on a mic, so the guidance is very, very clear with some volume. The, people come out of the classes, they're sweaty, faces are red. They're typically smiling, even though we just torture them for an hour. And what happens is 15 minutes, 10 to 20 minutes after, you start to feel this rush of endorphins. You start to feel energized. It's a little bit like plugging your cell phone in for an hour straight and not touching it, not looking at it. When you unplug it, the battery level has gone up significantly. So we have a whole crew of people across HRM that attend classes religiously at 5:15 in the morning. So there's a 5:15 crew and there's a 6:30 crew, right? So all these people, if you were to ask them, so take me completely out of this, ask them, tell me about the difference a day you do a workout versus a day you don't do an Orange Theory workout. And they all say the same thing. Yeah. When I do an Orange Theory class at 5:15 or 6:30, I have way more energy in the afternoon than the days that I don't. So it's weird because you think, well, if you slept in, you would be more awake and energized in the afternoon, but it's actually the opposite.
The opposite.
It's the opposite.
So if I'm one of these people that is thinking about making a lifestyle change or a health and wellness change or whatever, and I'm interested in what I'm hearing and I'm interested in Orange Theory, what would I do?
Well, I mean, we want you to come in and see the studio, experience the workout, and learn more about what makes us so much more than just a gym. You know, it starts with probably visiting our website, orangetheory.com, and then, you know, with your local, you know, if your computer notices where you are, then you just reach out to the local studio. And the first class is free. So we want you to come in and, you know, you got to be a little early for that first class, about 20 minutes or so. Client intake form, some health history, meet the coach, have an orientation inside the studio. And so the class itself will start right on time. So we pride ourselves in starting and ending time so that you can put the 1 hour into your calendar and know that it's going to start. If it's at a 9:30 a.m. class, it's going to start at 9:30. It's going to end at 9:30, and you can plan the rest of your day around.
Okay, Jeff, are we doing 5:15 or 6:30?
5:15 sounds early.
Okay, 6:30.
Do 5:15?
I have not done a 5:15. I have done 6:30, and I can attest that if you can get up and get yourself there, it's great. But it's also very addictive. Like many of our members use the word addictive. The days that they don't have an Orange Theory class is like missing your coffee that day. You're feeling like something's missing.
So how much progress have you made? You know, you stopped selling donuts and coffee and switched over to the gym.
Yeah.
Do you notice yourself feeling really, you're still feeling what really good about this decision to move with the gym?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, I'm in a way better place.
Okay.
You know, I don't feel like I'm, you know, on a path to our healthcare system anytime soon.
Okay.
I feel like that's not in the cards for me. I'm gonna live until something happens and boom, I don't spend any time in the hospital at all. That's one of my ultimate goals. So I definitely feel I'm on that path. Unfortunately, the business was not pandemic proof. So we got crushed pretty heavy, you know, with the closures, four reopens with different rules every time. Every reopen had different sets of rules. So even today, now that all restrictions are gone and it's a sort of a post-pandemic world, I guess, we're still probably, you know, maybe 75 to 80% recovered from pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
There's still some resistance of people to get into indoor group settings.
Yeah.
And, of course, the economy's changed. It's, you know, the inflation is off the charts and, you know, people that disposable income is less, and then prioritizing. Obviously, you got to pay your rent, and you got to, you know, put food on the table, and make sure you have clothing. And then after that, you got to make some decisions with your finances. Right?
I think some of that is not even like I don't have any reservation around going to a gym, but through COVID, I built a whole gym in my house.
Yeah.
So now I feel like if I'm going to pay $100 a month to go to a gym, why did I buy all the, you know what I mean? So I wonder I'm always curious how many people did similar things to me.
Yeah.
Right. You'll never know, I guess.
Yeah.
That's definitely a factor as well.
Yeah.
Peloton did extremely well during the pandemic, and then Peloton has fallen off the charts.
Yeah. We don't really hear much about Peloton anymore, do we?
Yeah. So, you know, the pandemic, you know, assisted their company and hurt ours, but now is going the other direction. So over time, you know, the thing about exercising at home is you know, you can pull up a YouTube video or you can do like a virtual with a coach, whatever, but that human interaction face to face is can never replicate Zoom or computers or Skype or whatever.
Well, even just this right now, I mean, we, Jeff and I do a lot of these podcasts where Jeff's at his house, I'm at my house, and our guest is wherever they are. But we're all together in the same room. People hearing this can't appreciate this, but we are.
Yeah.
And it's so much better, I find.
It's just the human interaction is something we all 100%. Need. It's part of our well-being, right?
Yeah.
You know what I also think is like, when you have a home gym, the biggest problem is talking yourself into using it.
Yeah, motivation.
Yeah. But similar to when you're in university, going to the library to study is like, it feels like you're doing something. Mm. But going to a fitness class, it feels like you're doing something, right? Like you're leaving the house, you're going to, and by the way, being surrounded with other people suffering makes your suffering way easier. Yeah. So I don't know why, but it does.
Well, and when you have an appointment, you're accountable to, there's a coach that's there for that appointment, right? So you're accountable to them. And especially if you have a workout buddy or a tribe or a group that you go with, you're more likely to attend. And then as you attend these classes and become regular, you start to see and feel results.
Yeah.
So I haven't been in a gym in a little while, just like this what I said. Does Orange Theory get the same ridiculous bump in January? And then like...
We do, yeah.
I've always been fascinated by that phenomenon.
Like, something about post-Christmas, all the eating and the gatherings and the drinking. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it's like... Okay, and then you throw New Year's right after that and the resolutions that go along with it. Definitely January, February are two of the better months. September is always a great month as well. People coming back from their summer vacations and the cottages and things like that. The kids get back in school. They want to get back in routine. So, there's definitely times of year where we see bumps, and those are some of them for sure.
You mentioned just playing on the – continuing on the health and wellness theme. You mentioned your parents and what they had to go through, and you mentioned you want to avoid being a burden on the healthcare system, and that's part of the reason that you're dedicating yourself to health and wellness, both as an entrepreneur and just as a lifestyle choice. Now, you're a cancer survivor, and you've been through a fair share of stuff health-wise. How did that change you in terms of, and here you are an elite athlete, you receive a diagnosis, you recovered. How has that changed you before and after?
Well, for 60 days, I had to go in for a chemo or radiation treatment and in a row. And that was January, February of last year. The weekend's off, sorry. So 5 days a week for 8 weeks straight or so. And when you're in the hospital only for a short period of time, like these appointments were typically 20 minutes to 45 minutes and you're out of there, the things you see and witness while you're there are not the prettiest, right? It's like, do you really want to spend much more time here than, you don't want to spend any time there if possible, but the more time you spend there, the more you realize you don't want to be there because it doesn't feel like living. It feels more like the pathway to the end of your life. But obviously everybody or most people at some point need some assistance to get their health back, right? Mm. But it's definitely an eye-opener. And for me, it confirmed that I don't want to spend any time there, if at all possible. So everything I do is about trying to keep myself active, mobile, healthy. And that goes well beyond the physical attributes of your body. It's as much mentally emotional as it is physical.
Mm. I've unfortunately spent more time in the hospital in the past couple of years than I wanted to as well.
Yeah.
It's remarkable, the sadness and just suffering that's taking place. And it's amazing to me that people can, work in that environment and just go home and be regular people. It continues to fascinate me all the time.
Yeah, health co-workers, I mean, obviously you got to tip your hat to them. And then through the pandemic, they had to just have all these additional steps and additional pressure and all the extra people that were waiting to be treated and all the pain and suffering and the people dying in front of them. Like, just unfathomable, really.
Yeah, so. I agree completely. Do you think it's interesting, though, that, like, I noticed that when I Googled you, and I noticed that you were talking about, taxing fitness, which I never really, the fact that, maybe there should be tax credits for gym memberships or, whatever, and you can elaborate on that. That's not really something I really gave a whole lot of thought to.
Yeah.
But, like, I just find there's, little to no government initiative going on and telling people, hey, By the way, being healthy is a really good thing to do. Okay. Like this should be, you know, and it seems like I've never had, most of the doctor interactions I've had have been, well, here's your pill.
Yeah.
If you can, you know, I have more patients. If you can leave as soon as possible, that would be great.
Yeah.
I just find that I feel like there's no, we have tremendous political will for all kinds of causes, but this does not seem to be one of them. I find it amazing that there's not a major push for this.
Yeah. And it's, I'm of the same mindset that, you know, doctors, they do, and they will continue to prescribe fitness to people as their way to getting better. You know, mm-hmm. could be for diabetes, could be for other diseases. But essentially, exercise, and movement, and the type of movement that gets your heart rate up a little bit, helps you live a longer, healthier life. I mean, there's no, you don't need a bunch of scientific research to know that, right? But there is all the science to prove that as well. Mm-hmm. It supports it. So if you want to take burden off the healthcare system, you know, obviously some of the focus needs to be on having more beds, more doctors, more facilities, and more places for people to access healthcare if they need it. But if you go to the other end of that and go into the preventative maintenance component, like let's encourage and motivate and incentivize, especially the younger population. I mean, we hear when people come and try Orange Theory, and then we present the options to become a member and make this a part of their regular routine and lifestyle, we run into objections quite often, right? And there's many different objections, but one of the main ones is cost, budget. And usually that objection comes from younger adults. So when kids, you know, get out of high school and into university and potentially out of university and into adult life, they quickly learn that living life as an adult is very expensive compared to living life at home with your parents. And so the whole budgeting thing becomes becomes a challenge for them. So incentivizing and motivating and encouraging people to create healthier lifestyles at an earlier stage when they're financially strapped or learning about managing finances is a great thing. I don't think you need to incentivize people who are already you know, well into their adult life and reasonably successful. And
sure, yeah.
So you can, it doesn't have to be for all. It could be for the people who are entering. But ideally, I mean, you start with something and,
to instill those healthy lifestyle habits early and hope they sustain.
Well, we'd all want a real healthy population.
Well,
just be a better place to live.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, politicians are looking for votes, right? And the people who vote are typically the people who are, it's proven that the people who vote are older. You don't see a lot of young.
It's also proven that the people that vote are alive, though.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So they're looking for votes, and they try to typically do things that encourage them keeping their job. Now, Ian Rankin is a member at Orange Theory, and I, you know, enjoy my time when I get to chat with Ian.
He's a fit guy.
Yeah. And when he was the interim premier, he was working with our fitness council of Nova Scotia, and we were having regular Zoom meetings about the introduction of some kind of a provincial tax incentive or credit. Of course, he ended up losing the election, and now Tim Houston is driving the bus for that, and we haven't heard much since he took over. So, you know, I've tried to put the bug in his ear on a few different occasions, but it hasn't.
Would you ever consider entering the political arena?
Only maybe to speak on a topic, but never as an occupation. Never.
Yeah. No. So what do you want your legacy to be? I mean, you're a father, you're a champion curler, you're an entrepreneur. What is it about your life, your legacy that you would want to be remembered by?
You know, I think starting as a great father, I mean, I think my relationship with my children is tremendous. And they're two boys, 19 and 16. Mm-hmm. And my 19-year-old works at Orange Theory as a sales associate in Dartmouth at the new location. And my 16-year-old and I are both members at Glen Arbor, and he actually just got a job there as an outside services attendant. So, you know, there I got one working in the fitness business, one working in the golf business.
But you're about the old block.
Yeah. And, and I have great rapport with both of them. I chat with each of them daily and see them all the time. And my 16-year-old is playing a lot of golf. So to me, that's my most important role on the planet. Mm. Obviously, when I entered Orange Theory and bought the rights for the region, developing the area and then letting it flourish and impacting, helping people live longer, healthier lives would be something that I'd like to be remembered for. A lot of it has started with focusing on myself and making sure that I had an outlet to be healthy, but also if I could impact, as soon as you impact even one person, you know, you've done something, right? And I've got hundreds of people that have told me how this has changed their life completely, right? Mm-hmm. They just could not find a fitness regime or routine that worked for them, that they could stay interested in, that they could stay committed to until they found Orange Theory. And now they can't get enough. They just come regularly. Like people who are non-gym people turn into gym people mm-hmm. because they become part of something that's way more than a gym. So, you know, the fact that I'm the one that's stuck my neck out, sold to Tim Hortons to get into fitness sounds crazy on the surface, mm-hmm. but ultimately it's a story that I'm proud of and, mm-hmm. I hope can inspire others as well.
Right on. Well, Mark, this was great. We've had you for 45 minutes. Time flies.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good place to end it. Yeah. Really appreciate you doing this, though.
Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate it, Marcel.
Thank you, Mark. It's awesome.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, bud.